I hope that people look at this as a canary in the coal mine type moment, because ultimately Bitcoin takes power away from powerful individuals. Controlling the money supply has always been a favorite control mechanism for emperors and kings and presidents and who have you all across history. So it's no different today. We're trying to stay and do something about it.
What's going on, everybody? Frank Corva here. Just wanted to start off by saying we had a slight technical glitch when we recorded the introduction to the podcast. So I'm just re-recording an introduction here, and then we'll just transition over to the actual recording in just a moment. So let me actually just introduce our guest here. The guest for today is Herman Vivier, who is the founder of Bitcoin Akazi, the Surfer Kids nonprofit, and just generally speaking, a prominent South African Bitcoiner who's been doing incredible work there. And now we'll transition back over to the actual recording where I discuss how some of that work that Herman is doing is in jeopardy. So to dive right in, Herman, first of all, how are you doing with everything going on? And then second of all, maybe bring us up to speed with what exactly is happening in South Africa right now as it pertains to Bitcoin.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for doing this. I'm doing all right. I mean, to be honest with you, the project that I help to run keeps me busy on a daily basis. So I've not been paying as much attention as I should to this. It's been sitting in the back of my head. Obviously, it's a massive concern. I'm quite concerned. I'm not so concerned for the people who, the small minority of people who have practiced perfect privacy from day one. The cypherpunks, I don't think have anything to worry about. It's the people who are newly onboarded, and it's the people who use custodial services that are currently KYC free. That I'm concerned about. I'm of the belief that in the interim period, non-KYC custodial Bitcoin services are an important part of the ecosystem. Obviously, we want to work towards an environment where everybody is doing self-custody, but at the moment, that's not quite possible in a non-technical way. So, yeah, that's my main concern. I'm also a little bit concerned for myself, for obvious reasons. I've made it quite clear for a number of years now that I'm very much interested in Bitcoin, and it's a fair assumption to make. I don't know. It's a bit of a wild situation, to be honest. I don't know what's going to happen. It was not unexpected. But what was surprising is the level to which the proposed regulations are, number one, incredibly vague. So when you were doing the intro there and you said these regulations could potentially ban Bitcoin, I thought to myself, well, a lot of people would say that is hyperbolic, but not really, because you could interpret the regulations in such a way. They are so vague that if you take the most extreme, not even the most extreme, if you take a relatively extreme interpretation, that is effectively what they do.
Nice. Also, Herman, if you don't mind, just one thing that I'm thinking here, some people who are tuning into this are probably familiar already with what's going on, but maybe let's actually rewind just a teeny bit before you continue. And I don't mean to stop your train of thought, but maybe just give an overview of what these regulations are proposing, what exactly they're, well, as you said, they're vague, so we don't know exactly what they're proposing, but a few of the stipulations, like the fact that you would have to sell your Bitcoin to the treasury, to the South African treasury, the fact that you would have to turn your Bitcoin over, your seed phrase over, or that these circular economies would essentially be outlawed. Can we touch on exactly what the regulations are proposing and then how you think they could be interpreted?
I'll do my best. I've read through them with the help of an AI, obviously, as most people have done. But I spent quite a bit of time interrogating the draft to try and understand exactly what is and what isn't possible. And my conclusion is that so this is a proposed amendment to the existing Capital Controls Act of 1961, I think. So the South African government passed the Capital Controls Act in 1961, and it's basically been what it is since then. So it hasn't really been updated. So this is a proposed update. And so people who actually support these new draft regulations are saying, well, this is just a modernization effort. We're just bringing that old act into the digital age. That's the sort of the benevolent interpretation of this. So what the regulations propose very, very basically is that essentially what it seems they're trying to do is to bring all Bitcoin and crypto activity. And look, by the way, first of all, these regulations pertain not only to Bitcoin and crypto, but to other forms of assets too. So gold and all kinds of other financial assets are covered by this. So it's not only relevant to Bitcoin and crypto, but I think it's quite clear that it's largely aimed at Bitcoin and crypto because it is a modernization effort. And essentially, at a high level, what it seems they're trying to do is to bring all of Bitcoin and crypto into a sort of a KYC walled garden, essentially. So first of all, you'd have to, and I think this is my biggest problem with these draft regulations, is that it seems as if the entire thing hinges on this undefined threshold. And so in these regulations, they mention a threshold, and say, for example, any holdings above that threshold would have to be declared, and would have to be deposited in a regulated financial institution. And then the obvious first question is, well, what is that threshold? Because if that threshold is, $100, or if that threshold is $10 million, those are two very, very different situations. Are you going to require that everybody who holds more than $100 worth of crypto or Bitcoin deposit that into a KYC financial institution? Or are you going to require that everybody who holds above $100 million or $10 million worth of Bitcoin or crypto deposit that into a KYC financial institution? That's two very different scenarios. And the threshold is undefined. So that's a big concern. I mean, that has, depending on what the threshold is, this thing could look very, very different. And though that bothers me, that you would choose to omit, well, perhaps not choose. I mean, one could also assume that this is pure incompetence or just total ignorance. It could be that. But the fact that that threshold is omitted raises a lot of very obvious concerns. And so there are other stipulations as well. I think the one that bothers me most, coming from a circular economy perspective, is that essentially sending Bitcoin back and forth between individuals becomes illegal above that threshold, because you're only allowed to send Bitcoin between regulated financial institutions. So I'm allowed to pay you in Bitcoin. I'm allowed to send you Bitcoin. But if it's above that threshold, and again, this threshold is undefined, so we have no idea what it is. But let's assume, for argument's sake, the threshold is $100. It would mean that any transaction with a value higher than $100, between two individuals would become effectively illegal, unless those two individuals are both transacting using exchange accounts. So if you're holding your Bitcoin on an exchange and I'm holding my Bitcoin on an exchange and I pay you from my exchange account to your exchange account, that's totally fine because we are transacting between two regulated financial institutions. But a peer-to-peer transaction on a wallet like Blink or Zeus or whatever, anything that's KYC free, once it's above that threshold, it's effectively illegal. And obviously, again, it depends on what that threshold is. I think this is my biggest gripe with this whole thing. If that threshold is low enough, it could completely kill circular economies. Well, I mean, it, 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 no, no, sorry. if that threshold is low enough, it could make circular economies effectively illegal unless the entire circular economy runs on a regulated exchange.
Right.
Which sucks.
Right. That's a kind way to put it. Yeah, it's terrible. You know, it's similar. It seems like on a certain level, it has a, it's meant, well, it's similar. It seems, well, not exactly. I was going to say it's similar to Executive Order 6102 in the United States. Which was when FDR, president, many decades ago, confiscated gold. It's not exactly that, because as you're saying, you could still transact through exchanges, but this obviously defeats the P2P nature of Bitcoin, the idea that it was meant to be transmitted without an intermediary. This would force those intermediaries into the equation. Why do you think this is happening now? Is there something? Well, let me rewind a little bit. So the party that's in power right now in South Africa is the ANC, and this was the party of Mandela. And Mandela has been on the record twice. He addressed the country twice while he was alive to say that he didn't believe in controls like this, in certain capital controls like this. So the party of Mandela is doing this thing that Mandela himself said shouldn't be done. Why do you think the ANC is doing this right now? Are they worried about the value of the South African rand? Are they worried about their own political power? Maybe a combination of both. What do you feel the impetus for this was?
First of all, it is actually quite similar to the confiscation executive order. that was issued in 1933, because part of these draft regulations actually do say that the state can force you to sell your holdings, your assets, to the state. I've had a few conversations, it's been very revealing, these conversations I've had with so-called normal people about this, because people are like, kind of like, yeah, that sucks, but I mean, it's not that bad because they're giving you the same value. And I'm like, no, wait, you don't understand. You don't understand. If the South African rand goes into a Zimbabwe territory, then me selling you my Bitcoin for X number of rands today is totally worthless tomorrow, because the number of rands you're giving me today means nothing tomorrow. This is what we saw happen in Zimbabwe. You know, one day you could buy, a loaf of bread with X number of Zim dollars, and the next day those same number of Zim dollars would be absolutely worthless. So once you're in a high inflation or a hyperinflationary situation, that essentially becomes confiscation. As I understand it. So it is actually actually pretty bad, because we've been fortunate in South Africa that the decline of the rand has been relatively slow. It's lost a lot of its value against the dollar over many years, but it's been relatively slow. Anyway, the other thing you mentioned, why now? Look, the ANC does not have outright power anymore. They were forced into a coalition government with the last election. And so, yes, the party of Mandela had outright majority power from 1994 until 2024. So essentially 30 years, they ruled the country without much resistance, because they had an outright majority. They always won more than 50%, way more than 50%. I mean, at one point they were close to 70% of the vote. I think in the early 2000s, at one point they had close to 70% of the vote. So, but they've been declining, and so they dropped below 50%, and in fact came very close to 40% in the latest election. So it's a pretty bad collapse they've had. And this is interesting, because it speaks to your question as to why now. This is not the first very unpopular thing that the ANC majority government, because it is still an ANC majority government. It is a coalition government, but the ANC is by far the largest partner in that coalition. Locally, it's referred to as the Government of National Unity, the GNU. The ANC is the largest partner in that, and it's an interesting question. Why now? Because it's not the first thing. The ANC has done several things over the last 2 years that have demonstrably contributed to their decline. They've signed several laws that it can be demonstrated actually made them less popular. And I think this is similar. It's gonna make them less popular. So why do this now? I don't know the answer to that question, but it's not different from the other things they've done. They've signed other laws which also, we at the moment there at the moment there is a law on the books, which is being challenged in court. So it hasn't really been implemented yet, but it's on the books. It's been signed into law. In fact, it was signed into law just before the previous election. And it's estimated the ANC lost about 5% of the national vote because of this law. And this law effectively nationalizes the private healthcare industry if it comes into effect. It's been signed into law. The president signed it into law, but it's being challenged in the courts. So it's not been put into practice yet. And nobody wants that. So why is the ANC enacting these communist policies that is very clearly costing them votes? I don't know. I guess my best guess is that they're so intimately intertwined with their communist ideology that they'll try and execute it, even if it means that they lose votes. They're essentially one can put it this way: the communist mind virus is so strong that the virus is destroying the host. That's my best
I think it's
guess.
a, no, it's similar to like. I think it sounds similar, not exactly the same, but similar to what happened in Venezuela, where you basically just have blind idea, just people who are blindly ideological, who just believe that we're going forward with this thing no matter what, because this is the mission and we don't care and blah, 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 not paying attention to reality, almost thinking within a vacuum or something like that, and just pushing forward no matter what. Maybe they think if they push hard enough on the other side of this thing, the communist utopia they have in their mind will become a reality, but we know that it's only likely going to get worse. History tells us it's only likely to get worse. And I don't even necessarily love using these words, communist, but I think that I think that's what's in that ideology is what's informing them, because it seems like you'd have to be blindly ideologically driven to continue pushing forward things that people don't want, especially in a system where you're democratically elected. So it seems like you're just sort of dealing with. I don't know whether it's a human psychology thing where this is what they've always said. So now to save face, they're just going to push forward with it no matter what. They're just not going to factor in reality and how people are reacting to what they're doing and just continue to kind of march forward. But it's really, I guess, scary. So broader context is wanting more control over everything in the country. So this side of this kind of money thing fits into a broader push for more control over the entire situation.
There's
I've seen a
also,
lot of,
sorry,
yeah.
just want to say, there's also the consideration that one has to take into account that the ANC government, look, they have been enacting communist-like policies, redistributive policies that you can demonstrate within very recent history, in the present moment, not even in history, in the present moment, you can demonstrate that these redistributive policies don't work. What we locally refer to as BBBEE, which stands for Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment, doesn't work. The idea is nice. The idea being that you have this disenfranchised majority, the non-white majority in South Africa that was disenfranchised during apartheid, obviously. And now you want to do something about it. It sounds fantastic. I mean, I've dedicated half my life to try and do something about that, but I don't do it in a way that's redistributive. The redistributive efforts have created a black elite or a non-white elite and have essentially enriched about 100 people to an insane level, our president being one of them. But none of that wealth has gone to the rest of the country, the disenfranchised part of the rest. I'm not even talking about the white part of the country. Let's ignore the white part of the country. Let's look at the four the let's look at the disenfranchised part of the country, that part of the non-white country that was disempowered and disenfranchised during apartheid. About 100 to 150 individuals out of 30, 40 million have become incredibly wealthy, and the rest of them are worse off in some ways than they were before. That's what the redistributive policies of the ANC majority government has done, And yet they continue on this path. And so, to your question, is it psychological? I have no idea. But one thing that one has to consider is it might not be ideological. It might also just be very practical because the government is running out of money. And
That's, yeah.
they've reached the point where they, we had a we're at that point on the so-called Laffer curve, where if they increase taxes any further, they're going to collect less tax revenue, because taxes in South Africa are already so high. I mean, our tax rate is comparable to the UK, except that if you're living in the UK, you get lots of stuff in return. In South Africa, you get almost nothing in return, because all of that tax money is going either towards corrupt individuals, or it's being used to fund a huge portion of the population that are unemployed. I mean, unemployment is above 30%. Some estimates are higher, but anyway, so it could be very practical. This could be a part of a larger effort to try and raise. I mean, they're effectively saying, listen, we'll give you our shitty currency in exchange for your high value assets. So, it's a pretty good fundraising mechanism if they can pull it off.
Yeah, 100%. Also, to rewind quickly to a point you made about the Zimbabwean dollar devaluing the way that it did, I think something that most people don't know about Executive Order 6102 in the United States is that the price of the dollar essentially got cut in half in value right after gold was conf I'm sorry, gold doubled in value right after it was confiscated from people in America. So this isn't just sort of a situation in Zimbabwe or something. We've seen time and time again governments from here in the United States to governments in Africa take assets from people, and then essentially those assets increase in value exponentially while the dollars or the fiat currency that the citizens are holding, basically their value gets cut in half or worse in most cases. So it's a really dire situation that I think most people, as you said, the normies, there, most people, we know this from being in Bitcoin world and trying to explain how money works to people. Most people don't really get how money works. They think about money nominally. They don't really understand why inflation is what it is. We have politicians like Elizabeth Warren telling them it's the greed of corporations that's causing inflation versus the fact that, I don't know, the United States goes $100,000 more into debt every 1 second. So there's a lot of different dimensions to this that I think are very difficult to understand, and there's cognitive dissonance. People struggle to understand these things. They don't want to believe they're real, all of these things. My other question to you, though, in regard to the government reacting to, let's just say Bitcoin specifically, for the sake of the argument I'm about to make or lay out, South Africa, I felt like it was really on the verge of becoming the next kind of quote unquote Bitcoin country. You have the work that Money Badger is doing, making it easy to pay from your Lightning wallet and have that payment settle over fiat rails. You have the work that KG and the Machankura team are doing. You have multiple circular economies, not just Bitcoin Akazi, Bitcoin Loxion, Bitcoin Witsand, a number of other circular economies. There was so much momentum around Bitcoin within the country, and it really felt great, at least from an outsider, but also someone that came to visit the country. I guess it's a little over a year ago now, January 2025. Do you think that they were noticing that momentum and wanted to slow it down? Like, hey, if we don't do something now to sort of stop this thing could become much bigger and we don't have control over it, et cetera. So were they reacting to I don't know what it is that I was seeing? Again, maybe that's biased because I'm a Bitcoiner, but were they reacting to that dynamic that was playing out?
I mean, the I think the best person to answer that question would actually be somebody from Money Badger. Cardle, as I understand it, have not only Cardle, but amongst other people, Cardle have had meetings with the Reserve Bank, and with the higher up officials, where. And I don't want to single him out. Maybe he doesn't want me to say this. So, but the point is that in meetings behind closed doors, and also in policy papers that in papers that guide policy, guidance papers, whatever you call them, they've laid out that this is where they want to go. So it's not something that happened overnight.
Got it.
I remember at the Africa Bitcoin conference, I think it was in Kenya. So that would have been the one before the most recent one.
December 2024. Yeah.
Yeah, it was either 24 or what, 23 was also in Ghana, right?
Ghana, right.
It
That's right.
might have been in 2023. There was I commented on, because there were several people there who had very positive reactions to some of the regulations coming out of South Africa, and I commented and I was like, hey, look, if you dig deeper into these regulations, they're actually telling you that we're on a collision course here. We just haven't formulated exactly how we're going to do this. But it was pretty clear to me that the South African government is not very welcoming of this. The people on the ground are very welcoming. The reality on the ground is very fertile for the kind of adoption that we've seen. But the government has not been very receptive in how they frame their approach. So it's not entirely unexpected. I think what was unexpected is the how vague the draft regulations are. Again, I mean I've said that before, but that was very surprising, because that's a huge red flag. If a government agency with a lot of power, and the South African Reserve Bank and the Treasury is probably the most powerful institutions in the country, if an institution with that much power comes out with the regulations that are so vague and can be interpreted in such a wide, then that's a big red flag. Because you have to assume that powerful people are going to abuse their power at some point. And then the other thing that we haven't mentioned is that the deadline for public comment is incredibly short. So, we've got a couple of days left, and it's only been a couple of days since they published the draft regulations. Normally, you'd have 6 months or so for public comment. In this case, they gave us less than a month for public comment. So that was surprising, but the essence of the draft regulations was not surprising. The government in South Africa has not been very welcoming, and there's a disconnect between people on the ground and the government, and there has been for more than a decade and a half, I'd say. Following the first democratic elections, the first two presidents, I think, had a very positive trajectory for the country. Both, I mean, basically just like looking at economic growth. But then, since the pre-World Cup high, things have been on a, and I'm referring to the Football World Cup in 2010. Since then, things have been on a slowly accelerating downward trajectory. And so it's not entirely surprising. I just we kind of wish I knew how this ends, though.
We are getting closer to that, as you just sort of alluded to it. So I have a question about this public comment. I believe there were two dates listed that they're going to be accepting public comment till May 18th or June 10th. Please correct me if I'm wrong on each of those dates, but why two dates? You mentioned to me in a DM, that you're not exactly sure. So do you think that the window will remain open until early to mid-June, or do you think May 18th is going to be the hard deadline?
I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm assuming that May 18th will be the deadline for public comment. I'm also assuming that the two dates was just pure incompetence. The level of incompetence is just undescribable. I mean, there are very, very simple administrative processes that I've been involved in personally, that has it's just it, I mean it's taken, for example, it's taken us more than 2 years to try and get a verification letter from the Department of Home Affairs that my wife is a permanent resident. We've tried legal firms, and it's just a fucking verification letter. I mean, the level of incompetence is just, yeah, it's just it's I don't know, especially at a national level. At a local government level, things are very different, especially the part of the country where we live. At a local government level, things are very efficient, but it's run by people with a totally different mindset. So I don't know. I'm guessing that confusion is incompetence. I don't think there's any malice behind the two date confusion or the spelling mistake in the email address where we're supposed to submit public comments, or I don't know. I'm
So I want to clarify for the listeners. So they actually, for the email you were supposed to send your public comments to, they posted the wrong address. They were off by a character or a letter or something, I think you mentioned.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah,
You don't think that
so
that was done on purpose to maybe have it, because obviously less public comments are going to reach them if they're sending it to an email address that either doesn't exist or the wrong email address.
I can understand from an outsider from an outside perspective, it looks like that was done on purpose. But having dealt with this government, and I mean, so just one other example. I mean, I like so I submit legal paperwork for our charity organization. That's behind Bitcoin Ekasi every year. And every year it's the same story. Every year I submit all the documents, and every year they get back to me with a letter saying, all this is missing, that's missing, that's missing. I know for a fact it's not missing. I submit the same documents again. They send a letter back, an email, this is missing, that missing, that missing. And it's been going on for year after year after year. And eventually, after four or five attempts, they say, okay, we've got all your documents. I know for a fact all the documents were submitted every single time. And I spoke to a lawyer recently who explained to me that they've encountered this before. And what's probably happening in the background is the person who receives these documents is so lazy to work or so incompetent. The easiest thing to do is just to respond and say the documents are missing, because that forces you to then resubmit and resubmit and resubmit. That's the level of incompetence. And so, having dealt with that, I don't think there's any malice in those mistakes. I literally think it's just pure, plain and simple incompetence. I don't think there needs to be any malice in that, because I think they're trying to achieve what they want to achieve with the regulations themselves. It's very clear, I think. I mean, lots of people have come out and have said, no, there's, you shouldn't be so pessimistic. You should give them the benefit of the doubt, da 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 da. And I'm like, dude, look at the last 30 years. Why on earth would you want to give them the benefit of the doubt? Look at all the corruption, look at all the incompetence. Just 2 days ago, there was another massive corruption scandal uncovered with government officials selling fake passports and fake visas to make money. So why on earth would you give them the benefit of the doubt? I think they're trying to accomplish what they want to accomplish through the regulations themselves. I think these little mistakes here and there is just pure incompetence. But that's just my feeling. I could be wrong about that, obviously.
Absolutely wild. Appreciate sharing all this context and your experience with it. It's really helpful. It's very sad and very disheartening, but helpful, I think, for those who are trying to understand better what's going on. Let's
Sorry
talk
to
about.
interrupt you. I just wanted to interrupt you there. Yes, it is sad, but at the same time, I'm still optimistic, because I think if you look at this in the broader context, like, I'm not a huge fan of democracy. It's got its flaws, but I think what's happening in South Africa is democracy actually working, because and this is kind of miraculous if you think about it. There should have been a populist revolt in South Africa by now. If you look at the number of people who live in abject poverty, there should have been. But somehow people have kept, voter turnout is not particularly high, but somehow democracy is kind of working. And I think what's busy happening is the ANC is getting voted out of power. They've lost, they went from almost 60% 5 years ago to just over 40% in this most recent election. And I think there's a very real chance that the ANC can be voted entirely out of government by the next election. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying there's a real chance if you follow the trajectory, or that they become a minority partner in the coalition government with the next election. And that is actually democracy working if you think about it. And if you think about it, if I think about it, I'm actually kind of hopeful, because. And this is what I've said this on other occasions as well. When you look at other things happening, not these draft regulations, but other similar things that this government is trying to push through, is that when South Africa went into its first democratic phase in 1994 with the first democratic election, that was not the transition to democracy. That was the first step towards a transition to democracy. But what happened then was a liberation movement called the ANC was then expected to turn themselves into a governing political party, which is that it's just that's unrealistic. You know, one day they're fighting a revolution with the military wing and everything. The next day you expect them to become bureaucrats. And it's like, no, that's not going to happen. And so what happened in the last 30 years is kind of expected. Cronyism, corruption, and so on and so forth. And if and when the ANC loses power and they let go of power without too much violence, then that would be the next step towards democracy. And these steps take decades, not years. So if the ANC loses its majority in 2029, which is when the next election is, and they become a minority partner in the government, and then finally they become an insignificant political party. And there's precedence for this, because the nationalist party that ruled during apartheid, that party doesn't exist anymore. They contested one or two elections after apartheid, and then they disbanded because they became irrelevant. I think the ANC is going to become irrelevant too. And I think that's the slow process of democracy in action. And I think that's how, probably realistically, that's how these types of regulations are resisted, by the party whose ideology informs this nonsense just actually becoming irrelevant.
Appreciate that perspective too. Yeah, I'm happy to hear you're optimistic. Makes me feel a little bit better looking in, I guess. And I also feel that the number of South African Bitcoiners who have either reacted to what I've posted about this or have DM'd me or emailed me saying we're pushing back, you're seeing people say no. And that's ideally what democracy should look like. So I think it's inspiring. It's part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation, because I think a lot of people will get behind it and share it because they probably share your same feelings. But I think it really is important that people do something. Now, aside from public comment, which is likely due by May 18th, what else can South African Bitcoiners do right now? And then maybe what else can Bitcoiners around the world do to support what's happening with South African Bitcoiners?
I think the most important thing that that can be done is just to kind of, I mean, there's a movement of local Bitcoiners that have formed. It's a loose association. There's no formal entity behind it, but it's a loose association of people who have just said, look, we're going to do what we can to resist this, and to get involved with that. I'm constantly retweeting stuff from their profile. They've got an X profile. I think it's at, I just got to double check the...
Is this the Property Rights Defense Group? Is that who you're speaking about?
Yeah, the Property Rights Defense Group. Yeah.
Let's mention it now, but I'll also put this in the show notes. I'm just looking at my phone. Pardon me for a second. But yeah, I've been in touch with somebody who's been working on that, and I've seen them tweeting. But let's just mention that quickly.
It's at PRDG_ZA.
At PRDG_ZA. That's it?
Yeah. On X. Perfect. Yeah.
I don't say Z as fancy as you say Z, so I appreciate that. So definitely check out what they're doing. I've had some people from this organization reach out to me. It seems like they're starting to gain a little bit of momentum, and that's something that I think anyone around the world can retweet what they're doing and obviously share what the likes of Herman is sharing from the Bitcoin Akazi handle, Luthando Nobambi, the community lead at Bitcoin Akazi, who's done such incredible work in developing, bringing merchants on board in the community and educating people in the community. And I think he had a really good tweet about this, and I hesitate to talk about this, especially as a white guy, but he said, Luthando, I think, is this amazing example, who was obviously very much a victim of apartheid, a black South African whose life has been greatly changed as a result of Bitcoin. His physical living conditions have been better. His lot in life, his job, all of these things have improved as a result of Bitcoin. One of my first thoughts, and I try to believe we can sort of speak to people's hearts and get them to realize the good things that Bitcoin can catalyze. If you think someone in the ANC, or maybe the ANC more broadly, if we were to speak about them as an entity, were to hear about a story like Luthando or the many people in Bitcoin Akazi whose lives have been bettered as a result of Bitcoin, do you think that they would potentially change their mind about this? Or is that just literally very... Okay, why do you say that? Yeah,
I think a combination of two things. I think the desperation and the ideology. They would listen to Lutando's story and they would actually just become more determined to exercise their democratic revolution. I mean, that's the irony of this, right? The ANC has this thing. Somebody described this very well once, and they've said, like, South Africa was this miraculous story after 1994. And since 94, the ANC has had two broadcast channels. The way they talk to the rest of the world and the way they talk to local South Africans are two entirely different conversations. And it's difficult to believe that in 2026, the ANC still has something that they call the National Democratic Revolution, which, according to them, has not been fully completed yet. Because the National Democratic Revolution is, in fact, a complete communist transformation of the country. It's insane. Like the level of, the level of insanity this, and this is what they literally tell local South Africans. And so they would listen to Lutando's story and they'll say, yeah, that's very nice, but, we have this National Democratic Revolution. And we haven't carried that out yet because we don't own everything that the whites used to own before. That's essentially what it comes down to.
Do you, so I know this sounds weird to say, and everybody, please, whatever, don't aim your bows and arrows at me, but for saying this, I guess on a certain level, if you're raised in a situation like apartheid South Africa, and so this is before maybe something like Bitcoin existed, if you were more to the left on things. So for example, there's a person coming to mind as you're speaking. I used to live next door in Namibia. I lived there for a short period of time, and I lived with a woman there, Black Namibian woman who I was l not living with her like in a romantic relationship. She gave me a place to live. It was I had gone there to work with a friend of hers, and I think she was very much raised with this idea that Cuba was an ally to, while the United States was very much okay with apartheid and the United States representing free markets, capitalism, all that stuff. Cuba wasn't, right? Russia, there were these communist nations that were very much like, no, we want to see Black South Africans be free and all of this stuff. So there's a sort of thing that's built in there, right? There's this almost emotional thing you wouldn't want to let go of. And also, I think Bitcoin is still a relatively new technology. The other problem with Bitcoin, something else that came to mind as I'm thinking about all this, is when I spoke with people on the ground in Nepal after the recent revolution in the country. What I heard from someone or from one person in particular who sort of spoke on behalf of many people on the ground is that a lot of the activists who were out protesting were more politically to the left. So when I asked if they were using something like Bitcoin and not the traditional structures, he was like, no, they don't touch that stuff because they just look at it as an extension of capitalism. And so obviously we know Bitcoin is much more than something like that. And I think that's like very, I think that's a very reductive way to look at it because it does much more for human beings than that. But I think all of this psychology and that emotion is sort of baked into the picture. And so I'm not saying it's right. I'm surely not saying it's right. But similar to like in Venezuela, when Chavez came to power, Chavez was the first darker skinned Venezuelan president, I think, in the modern, I think in the history of the country or the modern history. So people were like, I almost don't care what this guy's about. Like, that guy looks more like me, so I'm going to be behind him. And I know what played out in Venezuela, and it was very sad and all that kind of stuff, but there's something there. So do you think there are some of these dynamics at play of like people came up in a world where this thing that they ideologically blindly believe in was the answer, quote unquote, so they're struggling to let go of that being the answer?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, all the ANC revolutionaries were trained in communist countries. It was a bizarre experience in 2000, and I think it was this is in 2011 or 2012, just after my wife and I married. We went to a restaurant in Cape Town, and we sat down and we had a meal. I think it was an Ethiopian restaurant, but it was run by locals. And my wife made a comment. I don't know what she was. She made a comment in Russian. I don't know if she was on the phone. I can't remember. And this pitch black dude turned around and started speaking to her in fluent Russian, because he'd spent several years training in a military training camp in communist Russia. And so there's a very, very, very deep ideological connection there. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. And the other thing that's worth saying is that, and this is something that a lot of people struggle with. And I think if people could get their head around this, the world would be a much better place. But understanding something does not mean that you say it's right, or that you say it should be that way, or that you say you condone it, you support it. None of that is implied by understanding something. I can totally understand where this mindset of the ANC is coming from. I mean, put yourself in the shoes of somebody who grows up under apartheid, where everything is taken away from them because of the color of their skin. And now that person is raising their children. What do you think they're going to teach their children?
Right.
I can totally understand where this mentality is coming from. I completely understand it. I just also understand that the way in which they're trying to address the problem happens to be ineffective and, in fact, counterproductive. I totally get it. And this is why I say it's a miracle that there has not yet been a populist revolution in South Africa. Because if you look at the history, and if especially the last 30 years, where conditions have not improved, what should have happened is parties like the EFF that literally want to chase white people into the ocean. And I mean, that's the party who sings songs about killing people and shooting them and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of miraculous in a very positive way that party has not gotten a larger percentage of the votes. It's a small miracle that they're radical policies, because the ANC is one thing, but the redistributive policies of the EFF is on a whole other level. So it's a radicalized version of redistributive communism, as extreme as you can get. So it's a small miracle that they're not more popular, and that there hasn't been a populist revolt or uprising.
Very, very interesting. It's such a difficult situation, because I think of that dynamic that you just touched on there. It's like, it's almost that it's beyond the blind. It is a blind ideology, but it's like, it's this emotional sort of wall of like, well, I'm not going to believe in anything but this because of my experience with it growing up. And I know this, people are probably going to get mad at me for saying this, but I sympathize with that. I get it. I just wish people could maybe see what's happening in Bitcoin Akazi and other parts of South Africa as another way. But that's a very difficult wall to break through. Also, the other issue is that once a certain level of corruption starts to happen at the government level, I think officials start thinking, well, what if I'm taken out of power? Will I be tried for some of this corruption? Will other things happen? So there's a whole different layer there of like, well, we need to maintain power, because what will happen if we're not in power anymore? Obviously, you won't get the sort of deal flow, so to speak, that you're getting as a high-ranking bureaucrat or a politician within the country. So there's a lot of different factors there that I think affect this. And as much as I think like maybe we can appeal to people's better angels, I don't think that that's really going to be the thing that changes things here. Ideally, we see something happen with the Property Rights Defense Group, with South Africans commenting before May 18th. And as you said, some sort of resurgence of something that at least is a semblance of democracy, of actually people raising their voices, saying, you know, this is what's going to happen. And on a final note, on this topic, I do see a lot of people seemingly having this desire to stay and fight versus posting on X, hey, I'm leaving, I'm gone, South Africa, see you, goodbye. Is that just what I'm seeing on social media, or are people having that conversation as well? Like, are people ready to pack their bags and leave the country because of even the threat of what they're seeing right now?
I mean, my wife is not even South African. She moved here in 2010. And she told me two nights ago, look, I don't want to go anywhere else. Like, where would you go? I mean, where in the world? Dubai? You know, right, like, exactly. where would you go? I think the people that are going to leave have left. And I don't blame them. Again, it's one of those things where I don't agree with it, but I understand it. I completely understand it. And like you, I sympathize with people's position. I almost sympathize with what the ANC is trying to do, because I can understand if I was in their position, what would I do? I mean, I'm not a Yeah, this it's very easy to climb on a on on a on a on a on a tower and judge other people and say, yeah, this is wrong, this is that. But there's like, yeah, put yourself in their shoes. So yeah, I think the people that have left, the people that would have that were gonna leave have probably left. I think most people, I've not heard people say they want to leave. I don't want to leave. That depends on how bad things really become, but I don't think it's that much worse than what's happening in many other parts of the world.
Right.
If I look at the shit that politicians are getting up to in other parts of the world, I don't necessarily feel that, there's, maybe Bhutan or Nepal, or I don't know, but none of the big, attractive countries and the countries that seem to be rising powers, like China, like Russia, are also not places I want to go to. I don't that those seem to be the power centers that are on a upward positive trajectory, but I don't want to live there. South Africa might be on a downward trajectory, but I still have relative freedom here. So
I don't feel much different here, to put it mildly. And I feel like you didn't mention the United States there, but we have plenty of our own issues and corruption that we're dealing with here, obviously. And I think the whole world is taking note of that. And so I think what this is actually, in my mind, the situation this is creating in my mind is, I'm looking out my window here in New York, and we have our communist leader here in New York now, Zohran Mamdani and stuff. And it's I'm at a point where I'm like, oh, I'm not leaving either. Like I'm going to stay and fight too. And I think this is actually a really, really special thing about a lot of Bitcoin enthusiasts, Bitcoiners, et cetera, is that there is a certain level of like, okay, well, we have this tool now, we have this thing we believe in, it empowers us on a certain level, we're quote unquote kind of outside the system in a certain regard, having this tool. We're not entirely outside the system because we're still human beings that exist within social structures and government structures. But I do think that it is having an empowering effect on people who are just saying, no, I'm not going to run. I'm going to stay here and I'm going to fight it out. I had this conversation with a few people in Vegas coming from different parts of the world. I said Bitcoin 2026. Now, if I know that's a strange thing to say because there was a lot of also just like finance bros there, but there were some real Bitcoiners there who were talking about real stuff. And it does have me inspired that I think a lot of people want to stay, fight, change, do things locally, and make changes in their communities. So my heart is with you guys. I think it's inspiring. I think you're inspiring the world, the South African Bitcoiners. If people weren't aware that there's, the pushback that is happening there. I hope that this podcast has made you aware of that. And I hope you're looking at this, especially as a Bitcoiner, as a bit of potentially a canary in the coal mine moment, where I don't think this sort of effort ends in South Africa. I think we probably see something like this play out all over the world eventually. So at the very least, learn from what's happening and then if you can, on whatever way is possible, share whatever's coming out of the Bitcoin Akazi handle, Lutando Nabambi, his handle, a bunch of other people from South Africa, share what they're doing because it's the time to stand with the South African Bitcoiners and all that they've built because the Bitcoin adoption, the movement in South Africa has been amazing. If you haven't seen it for yourself or you're unaware of it, I mean, there's so much positive stuff happening there. And like you, Herman, I mean, maybe a little bit more after speaking with you, I am an optimist now as well. I think people will push back, and I think ideally this passes water, well, this passes, and this is, and you guys can continue with the important challenging work that you do on a day in, day out basis in Bitcoin Akazi and with the communities with whom you work. On that note, sorry about the little rant there. I was just feeling inspired by what you've shared. Anything we didn't touch on, or maybe places that you want to direct people to before we wrap up, whether it's handles or other websites or places where people can follow what's happening?
No, I mean, I would repeat the Property Rights Defense Group Twitter handle to go to. And yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that was well put. We're trying to stay and do something about it. And I think the very important thing that you said at the end there was that I hope that people look at this as a canary in the coal mine type moment, because, and this is something that I think people have gotten a little, speaking about Las Vegas, I think people sometimes get a little lost in this bullishness that that comes with number go up mentality, you know, where you think, oh God, what's going to happen to my personal stack if the US government starts buying Bitcoin? Oh, I'm going to be so rich. I'm going to be so. It's like, I don't see any large government embracing this technology for what it is. Ultimately, Bitcoin takes power away from powerful individuals. Controlling the money supply has always been a favorite control mechanism for emperors and kings and presidents and who have you all across history. So it's no different today. Being able to print money is something that that puts people in great positions of power, and taking that power away, it's not something that anyone is going to adopt in that one in one of those positions. And so I've been very skeptical about this government adoption narrative. I know there are some people that have a different perspective on that. I just don't think that governments adopt Bitcoin for what it is. I think what governments do is they try and this is exactly what's happening in South Africa right now. The governments try and put it in a box and put it into a an environment that they're familiar with, and then they're willing to accept it. And if you're willing to play in that sandbox with them, they'll be fine. But if you step outside, which is where Bitcoin really exists, Bitcoin exists outside that sandbox, then they're not fine with it. Then they're going to try and do something about it, because ultimately people who have power typically don't let go of it voluntarily. And so I hope people look at what's happening here and elsewhere and develop a slightly more skeptical attitude towards it. And you know, I've been talking about stablecoins, for example, and the big push behind stablecoins coming out of the US. And I think this is a great example of why people should have more skepticism towards that, because I don't think if the South African government, which is relatively small, has this kind of reaction, what is a large government going to do? And how on earth do you think they're having a positive attitude? I mean, anything that they can't control, they're not going to be positive towards. And this is what the South African government is trying to do. It's like, well, we can't control this, so we've got to bring it in. And yeah, so I think what you said there is the most important thing. I think the most important thing to take away from this is look at this as a canary in the coal mine type moment, and don't think that this is happening somewhere where you're not. It's probably going to happen where you are, unless you live in a tiny, insignificant country where the politicians don't have much power to begin with anyway. Then you're probably fine.
But you're, but or not, because if you are in a country like that, you're probably kind of a, in a, you'll be a part of a proxy fight with other major world powers, and the whatever happens in
Exactly.
those countries will sort of impact you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, that is the case, and I think another point to, you know, one of the big takeaways I think from Vegas was, you know, there we had the head of the DOJ speak, Todd Blanche, and we had the head of the FBI speak there, and a lot of the critique obviously was you guys didn't. You guys could talk all you want about America being the Bitcoin slash crypto capital of the world, but if you have two samurai devs in jail and you have another
Exactly.
crypto developer, Roman Storm, going back, getting his case retried after he having a hung jury on two of the three counts, you're not the crypto capital of the world. I quote this often.
Exactly.
Peter von Val yeah, Peter von Valkenburg of Coin Center said, yeah, sure, the United States is on pace to become the crypto capital of the world as far as the securitized, regulated version of it is concerned. But as far as P2P rights concerned, no, not so much. I hope we do, but we're not on pace to do that. And I think to the point of what you said, that is it. I think the attack on Bitcoin actually looks like major institutions adopting it or governments saying we're going to hold it as a strategic reserve asset. It's the rhetoric around Bitcoin is a store of value and stablecoins are the money you should be using. That's at least what the, I, in my opinion, that's what the attack on it looks like in the United States. Luckily, we have people like Jack Dorsey who are trying to have, you know, block anyone with a Square terminal start accepting it. But that's a whole different story. We have people pushing back globally. But I think, yeah, just believing that Bitcoin has already won and that there isn't going to be these sorts of government crackdowns globally is comedy, in my opinion. I don't mean to be mean or whatever, but it's I don't think we're in that sort of place because for Bitcoin to win, it has to exist the way that you've talked about it existing as freedom money outside the system. I'll leave with this. I saw NVK from Cold Card post something last night that I thought was pretty profound. So, you know, the most interesting thing about, or is it something, maybe not the most interesting thing. He said, you know, the MSTRs, the MicroStrategy / Stretch products of the world, will collapse if Bitcoin does not succeed as freedom money, because all the people who care about it, there's a false dichotomy between store of value and medium of exchange. It needs to be both for it to continue, for the system to work. And what's funny is that as you're trying to financialize it, you'll end up causing a financial crisis, because if you have so many financial products underpinned by it and you don't allow it to be what it is, then it ultimately fails. Jeff Booth gave a good talk on this at the conference as well. So not to get too far off track here, but Herman, I appreciate the fact that I appreciate all you're doing, you know, having been there to see it myself and having covered Bitcoin Akazi as a writer, you know, it's tremendously inspiring. I appreciate the fact that you're staying to fight and that you're willing to speak up about this. And yeah, I think that what you're doing is going to not set the pace, but set the tone for all Bitcoiners globally, not just you, but South African Bitcoiners in generally who are pushing back. And I think we're going to end up looking to what all you guys are doing as a model. So on behalf of Bitcoiners globally, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to speak today.
Cool, man. Appreciate it. Thank you for doing this.
Pleasure is all mine. All right, everybody. That is it for this. We will talk soon again. Thanks to Herman, and take it easy, everybody.
Thank you.